Chapter 6. Sadler lay in his bunk and tried to focus his mind on the past week. It was very hard to believe that he had arrived from Earth only 8 of its days ago, but the calendar clock on the wall confirmed the notes he had made in his diary. And if he doubted both these witnesses, he had merely to go up to the surface and enter one of the observation domes. There he could look up at the unmoving Earth, now just past full and beginning to wane. When he arrived on the moon, it had been at its first quarter. It was midnight over the Mare Imbrium. Dawn and sunset were both equally remote, but the lunar landscape was ablaze with light. Challenging the Earth itself was Nova Draconis, already brighter than any star in history. Even Sadler, who found most astronomical events too remote and impersonal to touch his emotions, would occasionally make the trip upstairs to look at this new invader of the modern skies. Was he looking at the funeral pyre of worlds older and wiser than the Earth? It was strange that such an awe-inspiring event should take place at a moment of human crisis. It could only be coincidence, of course. Andraconis was a close star, yet the signal of its death had been traveling for 20 centuries. One had to be not only superstitious, but also very geocentric to imagine that this event had been planned as a warning for Earth. For what of all the other planets of other suns in whose skies the nova blazed with equal or even greater brilliance? Sadler called home in his wandering thoughts and concentrated on his proper business. What had he left undone? He had visited every section of the observatory and met everyone of importance, with the single exception of the director. Professor McLaurin was due back from Earth in a day or so, and his absence had, if anything, simplified Sadler's task. When the boss returned, so everybody had warned him, life would not be quite so free and easy, and everything would have to be done through the proper channels. Sadler was used to that, but did not enjoy it any better. There was a discreet purr from the speaker on the wall over the bed. Sadler reached out one foot and kicked a switch with the toe of his sandal. He could do this the first time now, but faint scars on the wall were a still visible memento of his apprenticeship. "Yes," he said. "Who's that?" "Transport section here. I am closing the list for tomorrow. There are still a couple of seats left. You want to come along?" "If there's room," Sadler replied. "I don't want any more deserving causes to suffer." "Okay, you're down," said the voice briskly, and clicked off. Sadler felt only the mildest twinge of conscience. After a solid week's work, he could do with a few hours in Central City. He was not yet due to meet his first contact, and so far all his reports had gone out through the normal mail service, in a form that would have meant nothing to anyone happening to read them. But it was high time he got to know his way around the city, and indeed it would look odd if he took no holidays at all. His main reason for the trip, however, was purely personal. There was a letter he wanted to post, and he knew that the observatory mail was being censored by his colleagues in Central Intelligence. By now, they must be indifferent to such matters, but he would still prefer to keep his private life to himself. Central City was 20 kilometers from the spaceport, and Sadler had seen nothing of the lunar metropolis on his arrival. As the monocab, much fuller this time than it had been on the outward journey, pulled once more into the Sinus Medii, Sadler no longer felt a complete stranger. He knew at least by sight everyone in the car. Almost half the observatory staff were here. The other half would take their day off next week. Even Nova Draconis was not allowed to interfere with this routine, which was based on common sense and sound psychology. The cluster of great domes began to hump themselves over the horizon. A beacon light burned on the summit of each, but otherwise they were darkened and gave no sign of life. Some, Sadler knew, could be made transparent when desired. All were opaque now, conserving their heat against the lunar night. The monocab entered a long tunnel at the base of one of the domes. Sadler had a glimpse of great doors closing behind them, then another set, and yet another. They were taking no chances, he thought to himself, and heartily approved of such caution. Then there was the unmistakable sound of air surging around them. A final door opened ahead, and the vehicle rolled to a halt beside a platform that might have been in any station back on Earth. It gave Sadler quite a shock to look through the window and see people walking around outside without space suits. "Going anywhere in particular?" asked Wagnall as they waited for the crush at the door to subside. Sadler shook his head. "No, I just want to wander around and have a look at the place. I want to see where you people manage to spend all your money." Wagnall obviously couldn't decide whether he was joking or not, and to Sadler's relief did not offer his services as a guide. This was one of the occasions when he would be quite happy to be left on his own. He walked out of the station and found himself at the top of a large ramp, sloping down into the compact little city. The main level was 20 meters below him. He had not realized that the whole dome was countersunk this far into the lunar plain, thus reducing the amount of roof structure necessary. By the side of the ramp, a wide conveyor belt was carrying freight and luggage into the station at a leisurely rate. The nearest buildings were obviously industrial, and though well kept, had the slightly seedy appearance which inevitably overtakes anything in the neighborhood of stations or docks. It was not until Sadler was halfway down the ramp that he realized there was a blue sky overhead, that the sun was shining just behind him, and that there were high cirrus clouds floating far above. The illusion was so perfect that he had taken it completely for granted and had forgotten for a moment that this was midnight on the moon. He stared for a long time into the dizzy depths of that synthetic sky and could see no flaw in its perfection. Now he understood why the lunar cities insisted upon their expensive domes when they could just as well have burrowed underground like the observatory. There was no risk of getting lost in Central City. With one exception, each of the 7 interconnected domes was laid out in the same pattern of radiating avenues and concentric ring roads. The exception was Dome 5, the main industrial and production center, which was virtually one vast factory and which Sadler decided to leave alone. He wandered at random for some time, going where his stray impulses took him. He wanted to get the feel of the place, where he realized it was completely impossible to know the city properly in the short time at his disposal. There was one thing about Central City that struck him at once. It had a personality, a character of its own. No one can say why this is true of some cities and not of others, and Sadler felt a little surprised that it should be of such an artificial environment as this. Then he remembered that all cities, whether on Earth or on the moon, were equally artificial. The roads were narrow, the only vehicles small 3-wheeled open cars that cruised along at less than 30 kilometers an hour and appeared to be used exclusively for freight rather than passengers. It was some time before Sadler discovered the automatic subway that linked the outer 6 domes in a great ring passing under the center of each. It was really a glorified conveyor belt and moved in a counterclockwise direction only. If you were unlucky, you might have to go right round the city to get to an adjacent dome, but as the circular tour took only about 5 minutes, this was no great hardship. The shopping center and main repository of Lunar Chic was in Dome 1. Here also lived the senior executives and technicians, the most senior of all in houses of their own. Most of the residential buildings had roof gardens where plants imported from Earth ascended to improbable heights in this low gravity. Sadler kept his eyes open for any lunar vegetation, but saw no signs of it. He did not know that there was a strict rule against bringing the indigenous plants into the domes. An oxygen-rich atmosphere, it had been found, overstimulated them so that they ran riot and promptly died, producing a stench which had to be experienced to be believed when their sulfur-loaded organisms began to decay. Most of the visitors from Earth were to be found here. Sadler, a Selenite of 8 days' standing, found himself eyeing the obvious newcomers with amused contempt. Many of them had hired weight belts as soon as they entered the city, under the impression that this was the safest thing to do. Sadler had been warned about this fallacy in time, and so had avoided contributing to what was really a mild racket. It was true that if you loaded yourself down with lead, there was less danger of soaring off the ground with incautious steps, and perhaps terminating the trajectory upon your head. But surprisingly few people realized the distinction between weight and inertia, which made these belts of such dubious value. When one tried to start moving or to stop in a hurry, one quickly found that though 100 kilos of lead might weigh only 16 kilos here, it had exactly the same momentum as it did on Earth. From time to time, as he made his way through the scanty crowds and roamed from shop to shop, Sadler ran into friends from the observatory. Some of them were already festooned with parcels as they made up for a week's compulsory saving. Most of the younger members of the staff, male and female, had acquired companions. Sadler surmised that though the observatory might be self-sufficient in most matters, there were others which demanded some variety. The clear bell-like note, thrice repeated, caught him unaware. He looked around him but could not locate its source. At first it seemed that no one was taking any notice of the signal, whatever it might mean. Then he observed that the streets were slowly clearing, and that the sky was getting darker. Clouds had come up over the sun. They were black and ragged, their edges flame-fringed as the sunlight spilled past them. Once again Sadler marveled at the skill with which these images, for they could be nothing else, were projected on the dome. No actual thunderstorm could have seemed more realistic, and when the first rumble rolled round the sky, he did not hesitate to look for shelter. Even if the streets had not already emptied themselves, he would have guessed that the organizers of this storm were going to omit none of the details. The little sidewalk cafe was crowded with other refugees when the initial drops came down, and the first fiery tongue of lightning licked across the heavens. Sadler could never see lightning without counting the seconds before the thunder peal. It came when he got to 6, making it 2 kilometers away. That, of course, would put it well outside the dome in the soundless vacuum of space. Oh, well, one had to allow some artistic license, and it wasn't fair to quibble over points like this. Thicker and heavier came the rain, more and more continuous the flashes. The roads were running with water, and for the first time Sadler became aware of the shallow gutters, which, if he had seen them before, he had dismissed without a second thought. It was not safe to take anything for granted here. You had to keep stopping and asking yourself, what function does this serve? What's it doing here on the moon? Is it even what I think it is? Certainly, now he came to consider the matter, a gutter was as unexpected a thing to see in Central City as a snowplow. But perhaps even that. Sadler turned to his closest neighbor, who was watching the storm with obvious admiration. "Excuse me," he said, "but how often does this sort of thing happen?" "About 2x a day, lunar day, that is," came the reply. "It's always announced a few hours in advance so that it won't interfere with business." "I don't want to be too inquisitive," continued Sadler, fearing that was just what he was, "but I'm surprised at the trouble you've gone to. Surely all this realism isn't necessary." "Perhaps not, but we like it. We've got to have some rain, remember, to keep the place clean and deal with the dust, so we try to do it properly." If Sadler had any doubts on that score, they were dispelled when the glorious double rainbow arched out of the clouds. The last drops spattered on the sidewalk. The thunder dwindled away to an angry, distant mutter. The show was over, and the glistening streets of Central City began to fill with life once more. Sadler remained in the cafe for a meal, and after a little hard bargaining managed to get rid of some terrestrial currency at only a trifle below the market rate. The food, somewhat to his surprise, was excellent. Every bit must have been synthesized or grown in the yeast and chlorella tanks, but it had been blended and processed with great skill. The trouble with Earth, Sadler mused, was that it could take food for granted, and seldom gave the matter the attention it deserved. Here, on the other hand, food was not something that a bountiful nature, with a little prompting, could be relied upon to provide. It had to be designed and produced from scratch, and since the job had to be done, someone had seen that it was done properly. Like the weather, in fact. It was time he moved. The last mail for Earth would be cleared in 2 hours, and if he missed it, Jeanette would not get his letter for almost a week of Earth time. She had already been in suspense long enough. He pulled the unsealed letter from his pocket and read it through again for any final amendments. "Jeanette, my dearest, I wish I could tell you where I am, but I'm not allowed to say. It wasn't my idea, but I've been chosen for a special job, and I've got to make the best of it. I'm in good health, and though I can't contact you directly, any letters you send to the box number I gave you will reach me sooner or later. I hated being away on our anniversary, but believe me, there was absolutely nothing I could do about it. I hope you received my present safely, and I hope you liked it. It took me a long time to find that necklace, and I won't tell you how much it cost. Do you miss me very badly? God, how I wish I was home again. I know you were hurt and upset when I left, but I want you to trust me and to understand that I couldn't tell you what was happening. Surely you realize that I want Jonathan Peter as much as you do. Please have faith in me, and don't think that it was because of selfishness or because I don't love you that I acted as I did. I had very good reasons, which one day I'll be able to tell you. Above all, don't worry and don't be impatient. You know that I'll get back as soon as I can, and I promise you this. When I'm home again, we'll go ahead. I wish I knew how soon that would be. I love you, my darling. Don't ever doubt that. This is a tough job, and your faith in me is the one thing that keeps me going. He read the letter with great care, trying for the moment to forget all that it meant to him, and to regard it as a message that a complete stranger might have written. Did it give too much away? He did not believe so. It might be indiscreet, but there was nothing in it that revealed his location or the nature of his work. He sealed the envelope, but put no name or address on it. Then he did something that was, strictly speaking, a direct violation of his oath. He enclosed the letter in another envelope, which he addressed with a covering note to his lawyer in Washington. "Dear George," he wrote, "you'll be surprised to see where I am now. Jeanette doesn't know, and I don't want her to worry. So please address the enclosed to her and post it in the nearest mailbox. Treat my present location as absolutely confidential. I'll explain it all one day." George would guess the truth, but he could keep secrets just as well as anyone in Central Intelligence. Sadler could think of no other foolproof way of getting his letter to Jeanette, and he was prepared to take the slight risk for his peace of mind, and for hers. He asked the way to the nearest mailbox. They were hard to find in Central City, and slid the letter down the chute. In a couple of hours, it would be on the way to Earth. By this time tomorrow, it would have reached Jeanette. He could only hope that she would understand, or if she could not understand, would suspend judgment until they met again. There was a paper rack beside the mailbox, and Sadler purchased a copy of the Central News. He still had several hours before the monorail left for the observatory, and if anything interesting was going on in town, the local paper would presumably tell him about it. The political news received such little space that Sadler wondered if a mild censorship was in force. No one would have realized that there was a crisis if he went by the headlines alone. It was necessary to search through the paper to find the really significant items. Low down on page 2, for example, was a report that a liner from Earth was having quarantine trouble off Mars and was not being allowed to land, while another on Venus was not being allowed to take off. Sadler was fairly sure that the real trouble was political rather than medical. The Federation was simply getting tough. On page 4 was a still more thought-provoking piece of news. A party of prospectors had been arrested on some remote asteroid in the vicinity of Jupiter. The charge, it seemed, was a violation of space safety regulations. Sadler suspected that the charge was phony, and that so were the prospectors. Central Intelligence had probably lost some of its agents. On the center of the page was a rather naive editorial making light of the situation and expressing the confident hope that common sense would prevail. Sadler, who had no illusions about the commonness of common sense, remained skeptical and turned to the local news. All human communities, wherever they may be in space, follow the same pattern. People were getting born, being cremated, with careful conservation of phosphorus and nitrates, rushing in and out of marriage, moving out of town, suing their neighbors, having parties, holding protest meetings, getting involved in astonishing accidents, writing letters to the editor, changing jobs. Yes, it was just like Earth. That was a somewhat depressing thought. Why had man ever bothered to leave his own world if all his travels and experiences had made so little difference to his fundamental nature? He might just as well have stayed at home, instead of exporting himself and his foibles at great expense to another world. "Your job's making you cynical," Sadler told himself. "Let's see what Central City has in the way of entertainment." He had just missed a tennis tournament in Dome 4, which should have been worth watching. It was played, so someone had told him, with a ball of normal size and mass, but the ball was honeycombed with holes, which increased its air resistance so much that ranges were no greater than on Earth. Without some such subterfuge, a good drive could easily span one of the domes. However, the trajectories followed by these doctored balls were most peculiar, and enough to induce a swift nervous breakdown in anyone who had learned to play under normal gravity. There was a cyclorama in Dome 3, promising a tour of the Amazon Basin, mosquito bites optional, starting at every alternate hour. Having just come from Earth, Sadler felt no desire to return so promptly. Besides, he felt he had already seen an excellent cyclorama display in the thunderstorm that had now passed out of sight. Presumably, it had been produced in the same manner, by batteries of wide-angle projectors. The attraction that finally took his fancy was the swimming pool in Dome 2. It was the star feature of the Central City Gymnasium, much frequented by the observatory staff. One of the occupational risks of life on the moon was lack of exercise and resultant muscular atrophy. Anyone who stayed away from Earth for more than a few weeks felt the change of weight very severely when he came home. What lured Sadler to the gym, however, was the thought that he could practice some fancy dives that he would never dare risk on Earth, where one fell 5 meters in the first second and acquired far too much kinetic energy before hitting the water. Dome 2 was on the other side of the city, and as Sadler felt he should save his energy for his destination, he took the subway. But he missed the slow-speed section, which led one off the continuously moving belt, and was carried willy-nilly on to Dome 3 before he could escape. Rather than circle the city again, he retraced the way on the surface, passing through the short connecting tunnel that linked all the domes together at the points where they touched. There were automatic doors here that opened at a touch and would seal instantly if air pressure dropped on either side. Half the observatory staff seemed to be exercising itself in the gym. Dr. Moulton was sculling a rowing machine, one eye fixed anxiously on the indicator that was adding up his strokes. The chief engineer, eyes closed tightly as per the warning instructions, was standing in the center of a ring of ultraviolet tubes, which gave out an eerie glare as they replenished his tan. One of the MDs from surgery was attacking a punch bag with such viciousness that Sadler hoped he would never have to meet him professionally. A tough-looking character who Sadler believed came from maintenance was trying to see if he could lift a ton. Even if one allowed mentally for the low gravity, it was still awe-inspiring to watch. Everybody else was in the swimming pool, and Sadler quickly joined them. He was not sure what he had expected, but somehow he had imagined that swimming on the moon would differ drastically from the same experience on Earth. But it was exactly the same, and the only effect of gravity was the abnormal height of the waves and the slowness with which they moved across the pool. The diving went well as long as Sadler attempted nothing ambitious. It was wonderful to know just what was going on, and to have time to admire the surroundings during one's leisurely descent. Then, greatly daring, Sadler tried a somersault from 5 meters. After all, this was equivalent to less than a meter on Earth. Unfortunately, he completely misjudged his time of fall and made half a turn too many, or too few. He landed on his shoulders and remembered too late just what a crack one could give oneself even from a low height if things went wrong. Limping slightly and feeling that he had been flayed alive, he crawled out of the pool. As the slow ripples ebbed languidly away, Sadler decided to leave this sort of exhibitionism to younger men. After all this exertion, it was inevitable that he join Moulton and a few of his other acquaintances when they left the gymnasium. Tired but relaxed, and feeling that he had learned a good deal more about the lunar way of life, Sadler leaned back in his seat as the monocab pulled out of the station and the great doors sealed tight behind them. Blue cloud-flecked skies gave place to the harsh reality of the lunar night. There was the unchanged Earth, just as he had seen it hours ago. He looked for the blinding star of Nova Draconis, then remembered that in these latitudes it was hidden below the northern edge of the moon. The dark domes, which gave so little sign of life and light they held, sank beneath the horizon. As he watched them go, Sadler was struck by a sudden somber thought. They had been built to withstand the forces that nature could bring against them. But how pitiably fragile they would be if ever they faced the fury of man.